This is the day that we have been given. It is beyond our making. It is beyond our control. And yet we receive it as a time to be present and to be together. Let us, in this time of togetherness, in this time of worship, find what we can within ourselves and from one another and from that which speaks to us from beyond ourselves, so that we may make of this day that we have been given what we can, what we may, and what will enrich us and those around us. Was able to encounter a meditation by the Vietnamese Zen Buddhist monk Thich Nhat Hanh, which seems particularly appropriate for our prayer this morning. And in preparation for this time of prayer, this time of meditation, I invite you to sit back, to let the tension fall away from your muscles. I invite you to let the cares and concerns drift slowly away from your mind. And as you do so, find yourself reaching deep within, reaching far beyond to connect with that which you find sacred. In the words of Thich Nhat Hanh, let us be at peace with our bodies and our minds. Let us return to ourselves and become wholly ourselves. Let us be aware of the source of being common to us all and to all living things, evoking the presence of the great compassion. Let us fill our hearts with our own compassion toward ourselves and towards all living beings. Let us pray that we ourselves cease to be the cause of suffering to each other. With humility, with awareness of the existence of life and of the sufferings that are going on around us, let us practice the establishment of peace in our hearts and on earth. Amen. Please join me in the silence.
The story is told of the Chinese Zen master, Guti. Guti was famous for saying absolutely nothing about his teachings. Whether it was the nature of Buddha, or the way to enlightenment, or some other aspect of Zen, whatever he would be asked about, Guti would simply hold up one finger and smile. Before long, the master's young attendant took to mocking this gesture. A visiting scholar once asked the boy what his master taught, and the attendant answered by raising a finger going, When Guti returned from his travels and he heard what the young servant had done, he immediately went to the attendant, seized the boy's hand, and chopped off his finger with a knife. The young boy ran screaming from the room in complete agony, but just as he was about to leave, he heard his master call to him. The boy turned around, and Guti went. In that moment, the young boy attained enlightenment. What is the moral of this story? I don't know either. And you know, I can't claim to know, because, as you may have guessed, this is not just a fable or a parable. It's a koan. Koans are short discourses common to many of the Zen schools of Buddhist thought and practice. They do not make rational sense. And that's the point of them. Maybe. Though, given their vague nature, it's tough to discern what their purpose ultimately is. But whatever the purpose, koans serve to stop us in our logical tracks. They stop our attempts to analyze issues. For example, the famous koan, "What is the sound of one hand clapping?" That's not just a riddle to be solved. Excuse me. It's neither a riddle to be solved, nor is it cause for some novice Zen practitioners to walk around the monastery going, no, nothing like that. Koans are means for us to look at Dharma, as Buddhists refer to truth or reality, in new ways. Koans are tools for us to change. And change is important because nothing is permanent and suffering is everywhere. Now, perhaps hearing those words, you're thinking to yourself, I got out of bed this morning to hear that. Yes, indeed. For these are central claims of Buddhist teachings. And many of us Unitarian Universalists engage the teachings of Buddhism on some level. But if we're to do so fully, to do so authentically, we have to take them seriously. We cannot whitewash over these views, take some idealized or romanticized Western look at this Eastern religion, which has so much more to offer than we tend to realize. If we rip Buddhism out of its cultural context, we do so at our own loss. But maybe radical impermanence, maybe commonplace suffering, are not such bad news as they may sound like. I truly believe that hope can be found in a worldview that stresses both the impermanence of reality and the pervasiveness of suffering. And I'll start with that second one, that suffering is everywhere. Now, it may seem an odd place to start, but it's actually where the Buddha himself started. After he was enlightened following his weeks of meditation under the Bo tree, the story of the Buddha's life tells us that he preached his first sermon to some of the wandering ascetics with whom he had previously fasted in the Deer Park in northern India. The middle way that he preached to them was based, as many of you know, upon four noble truths. And the first of these, of course, is that all life is suffering. Now, that does not mean that moments of joy are non-existent. Happiness is not an illusion. There are real moments of delight, but they do not last. Rather, we can be lulled by these moments into a false sense of security, into a naive optimism that would have us believe that this is the best of all possible worlds. Now, what the Buddha is warning against here is a life that's seen through rose-colored glasses. He reminds us that the suffering we would dismiss is not minor. The suffering we would ignore is not illusory. And the suffering we would denigrate as being deserved by the sufferer is not necessarily deserved. Now, I want to stress that last point. Just because you suffer, the Buddha does not insist that you earned your suffering. Now, some will disagree with that interpretation. They'll refer to karma, the Buddhist view of cause and effect. Many people who uphold the doctrine of karma argue that suffering is the karmic effect of some past deed, possibly from a previous lifetime. Indeed, according to the Buddhist view, that is sometimes the case, but not always. We should not take such a simplistic view of karma that what we end up doing is simply putting an Eastern veneer on the doctrine of original sin. Original sin is upheld by some Christian theologians, not all, but too many. And it claims that humanity is inherently sinful. Some would even say depraved. Unitarians historically have rejected the doctrine of original sin, and with good reason. I'd warn any religious liberal against considering a similar view, whether its advocates follow Gautama Buddha or John Calvin. No, the truth of suffering is simply that it's present in our lives, whether or not it's deserved. Bad things really do happen to good Buddhists. On the other hand, sometimes we're so used to the pervasiveness of suffering that we do not allow ourselves to escape it. We don't have to make our struggles into idols. There's no need for us to wear only black, read Edgar Allan Poe all day, and drink absinthe. And yet, some of us do let ourselves get carried away with focusing on the suffering we face. As Thich Nhat Hanh has said, people have a hard time letting go of their suffering. Out of a fear of the unknown, they prefer suffering that is familiar. Out of a fear of the unknown, they prefer suffering that is familiar. That quote should be memorized by every congregational growth consultant, repeated at every seminar. Oh, that's a topic for another sermon. But the point is, it's easy to remain stuck in what we know, even when it makes our lives or the lives of those around us miserable. Put simply, suffering is. Some of us try to deny suffering. Like the Buddha's father, he had heard a prophecy that his son could grow to become a great king that united all of India. So he tried to protect him from all of the bad experiences of life in hopes that he would stay in the palace and assume his place as king. That denial of suffering didn't work. Other people wallow in suffering, like the wandering ascetics with whom Buddha later associated himself after he indeed did leave the palace, fasting to the edge of starvation. But Gautama Buddha admonished the ascetics in Deer Park after his enlightenment not to fall into either of those extremes, but rather to accept the reality of suffering and take a balanced look at it. For when we take suffering just seriously enough, without making light of it, without being overwhelmed by it, we can deal constructively with the trials that we do face in life, and that ability to deal constructively is good. So the benefit of approaching suffering via the middle way is that we can deal with it well. But what about impermanence? Well, again, if we can approach this truth with the right balance, we can recognize positive rewards from acknowledging that nothing is permanent. And it relates to the Buddha's second noble truth about the cause of suffering. As I said earlier, it would be overly simplistic to attribute all suffering to the effects of bad karma. Rather, Buddha names the cause of suffering with the Sanskrit word tanha. It's often translated as desire. But the word really has a more nuanced meaning than just that. What causes us to suffer, according to Buddha, is the desire to cling to specific aspects of our present lives, or of our past, or of particular ideals for our future. But to cling to these aspects which we cannot maintain, which we cannot hold. We suffer when we fail to realize that things change, that we cannot maintain the status quo. Let me give you a specific example. Granted, it's a hypothetical one, but I hope it illustrates the point well. Imagine some Sunday morning a few years in the future. I come up to the pulpit of the church I'm serving at the time to deliver the sermon. I look out at the congregation and go. Then I announce the final hymn and the offering. Now imagine the following Monday morning when I'm filling out unemployment forms and looking for a new church to serve. Well, even if I was politically naive enough to pull such a stunt, the point is that I need not cling too tightly to my position serving that church. And certainly I faced that reality head on recently. As I said at the beginning of our service, I currently serve as interim minister at our church in San Antonio. And indeed, it's understood that that is a temporary ministry. And in fact, it's coming to a close at the end of this month. And I'll be leaving there about the same time that my friend and colleague Jack will be leaving here. I'll be moving on to serve where I've been called, our Church of the Brazos Valley in College Station, Texas. It's a wonderful opportunity, but it's also a reminder that I need to let go of the reality that I've experienced this last year in San Antonio so that I can embrace the new reality in College Station. And indeed, College Station is very much its own reality. Yeah, something told me in Austin I could get away with saying that. But it's going to be tough, for I've formed some wonderful relationships with many of the people there at the church in San Antonio and with the church as a whole. Of course, I'm going to grieve that loss. I'm going to miss those relationships, and I'm going to miss so much about what I have experienced there in San Antonio. And yet, I know there are so many riches awaiting me. And there are riches awaiting San Antonio in their new relationship with their new called minister, Reverend Brett Lorty, who will be starting there in about a month's time. If I was to cling too tightly to those, cling too tightly to the people and the times and the experiences that I've had in San Antonio, it would be tougher for them to let me go to accept their new ministry. It would be tougher for me to let go to enter fully and authentically into my new ministry in College Station. So yes, I'm going to miss the familiar territory and certainly the regular presence of so many wonderful people that have enriched my life over this past year there. We'll still see each other again, but not as often as I'd like. And I suspect many of you have a similar story from your own experience of how a move from a beloved place has impacted you, how it's changed the fabric of your life. The leaving may make you sad, as leaving San Antonio makes me sad on some levels. And yet, by working to maintain that balance to move forward, by remembering the positive results to come from that, we can be enabled to move on, in my case with my calling, so that I can hope to go where I've been called. Thich Nhat Hanh again expresses it well. Hope, he writes, is important because it can make the present moment less difficult to bear. If we believe that tomorrow will be better, we can bear a hardship today. And I might add, this quote shows the other positive consequence to impermanence. It's not just the good parts of life that we can't hold on to. The bad stuff changes and ends as well. Letting go of the negative aspects of our life can help us to move forward with hope, just as having hope can help us to let go. You know, there's a third treasure to be found in the Buddhist worldview. Well, there are many others, but a third that I want to focus on. It's yet another truth, but not one of the Four Noble Truths that Buddha listed in his Deer Park sermon. Nonetheless, it's been advocated throughout the Buddhist tradition. It's the idea that everything is interconnected. This is not just an ecological principle, though certainly it does support right relationship between the human world and the natural world. In addition to that, though, it's also a metaphysical claim. That is to say, it's a claim about reality's ultimate nature. Just as every aspect of reality is transient or changing, It's also all connected. Suffering is a pervasive reality. So is time and change, but also relation. There's a beautiful metaphor for this view in the canon of Buddhist scriptures, particularly in the Avatamsaka Sutra. It speaks of the way in which all elements of reality interpenetrate one another. It is written, "Far away in the heavenly abode of the great god Indra, there is a wonderful net which has been hung by some cunning artificer in such a manner that it stretches out indefinitely in all directions. In accordance with the extravagant tastes of deities, the artificer has hung a single glittering jewel at the net's every node. And since the net itself is infinite in dimension, the jewels are infinite in number. There hang the jewels, glittering like stars of the first magnitude. A wonderful sight to behold. If we now arbitrarily select one of the jewels for inspection, if we look closely at it, we will discover that in its polished surface, there are reflected all the other jewels in the net, infinite in number. Not only that, but each of the jewels reflected in this one jewel is also reflecting all the other jewels, so that the process of reflection is infinite. Now, if an image like this feels familiar to many Unitarian Universalists, that's not surprising, particularly those of us most familiar with our statement of principles for that our association of congregations has adopted. The seventh principle is respect for the interdependent web of all reality of which we are a part. Certainly that seems to echo the metaphor, and it's my understanding that the person who proposed this wording actually had in mind the image of Indra's jeweled net when he suggested this rewrite of the seventh principle, before it had been an extremely bland and uninspiring statement intended only to express environmental consciousness. But by rewriting it in this way, it was deepened to speak to us richly about the natural world, yes, but also about the world more generally. Thich Nhat Hanh calls this concept interbeing, that the being of everything in reality is intertwined with every other being. It's the concept behind my favorite quote from his writings. He says, "We are here to awaken from the illusion of our separateness." We are here to awaken from the illusion of our separateness. Thus we awaken to the realizations that suffering is always with us, but never overwhelming us. That there are no permanent circumstances to our lives, either positive or negative, and that this transient, afflicted life we live is intrinsically bound to all other lives. I can't help thinking of Gucci's assistant. His suffering was plain. So was his physical change, the loss of his finger. Yet, in his master's surprising gesture, after an even more surprising act of violence, the attendant became aware of something, made some connection in his mind that brought him to a new outlook on life. He experienced directly these seemingly abstract concepts that nothing is permanent, that suffering is everywhere, and that everything is interrelated. And when we take these truths, each with the other, a metaphor strikes me for this worldview. It seems to me that we can see life lived by these truths as a dance. And I don't mean a choreographed solo, but that glorious, messy interplay that a couple has when dancing with one another. I'll even give a specific example from my personal experience. Now, on the surface, this is going to sound far removed from Buddhism. And yet, I think this illustrates these three ideas well. There's a dance hall that I've visited many times on the east side of Dallas. It was built decades ago by Czechoslovakian immigrants to the area. It's called the Czech Club. Now, imagine a dance floor at least two-thirds the size of the seating area of this sanctuary, possibly covering the entire area, square in shape, and in the middle of a still larger room. On three sides of the dance floor are dozens of tables that seat hundreds of people. The stage is on the fourth side. At the better attended dances, that dance floor is full of people, absolutely packed. The better dancers move in a counterclockwise circle around the dance floor. Novices, myself included, stay in the center or perhaps in the corners. We try not to get caught up in the rush. One of the real treats of having attended dances at this place is to see the best dancers, who are often these elderly Czech American couples that glide across the floor with the kind of elegant grace that can only come from a lifetime of sharing the dance with the same partner and knowing intuitively each move that the other will make. Their interrelatedness and their ability to keep pace with the changes in the music are impeccable. As for me, like I said, I'm usually in the corner trying not to step on my partner's feet or trip over my own. Suffering of many kinds can occur on a dance floor. But indeed, there on that dance floor, it's all there. Interrelatedness, change, yes, even some suffering. We take them together, and in doing so, we realize that these truths are not so depressing after all. But by living in accordance with them, they help us to engage life fully, to engage life richly, and to do so with our eyes, our ears, and our hearts, open to the flow of life's dance. Amen.